From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with singer Judy Collins. She looks back on her life in music in her new autobiography, Trust Your Heart. Also today, I talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Del Tredici. He's at the forefront of what's been called the return to tonality. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward plays a couple of break-in records, singles where a reporter's questions are answered with excerpts from top 40 hits, and book critic John Leonard reviews A Way of Hope, the autobiography of Solidarity leader Lech Walesa. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. In the 1960s, many young people discovered traditional folk music through Judy Collins' records, albums such as Made of Constant Sorrow and Golden Apples of the Sun. Collins also introduced new songs by contemporary composers like Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, and Joni Mitchell. Her career has had its ups and downs since the 60s, and so has her personal life. Listeners who only knew Judy Collins through her songs will be surprised by some of the things she reveals about herself in her new autobiography. She had polio as a child. Shortly after she started her career, she divorced her husband and lost custody of her son. Though her popularity coincided with the psychedelic era, she only tried LSD twice. But later in her life, she realized she had become dependent on alcohol. Judy Collins' autobiography is titled Trust Your Heart. It's also the title of her new album. She wrote the title song.
In the sky, the phantom moon appears at midday to join the sun in some forgotten dance. In their mind, our voices tremble with reflections of what we know.
I spoke with Judy Collins from the NPR Bureau in New York earlier today. She told me that she never really saw herself as a folk singer.
Well, I've had a sort of an eclectic life in music, which began, as I talk about in the book, began as a classical pianist. But even so, I was raised in a family where my father made his living playing the songs of Rodgers and Hart and Cole Porter. So I was torn in many directions. I think I was formed as a storyteller, and when I started singing folk songs in the late 50s, that was my first, in a way, my first big change, because I stopped playing classical piano and Debussy and began to collect songs and sing and play. But then as I started to work in music, make records, I found that my own song taste was taking me in directions that led me right back to theater music. Rodgers and Hart, Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht. By the time I made In My Life, which was my sixth album, I had a basket of songs that were very different and unusual and were not folk songs at all. But somehow the term folk singer has clung to me in some respects, and it is valid in some respects, although I find that I prefer to think of myself as a singer.
As you mentioned, when you were a child, you took piano lessons and studied quite seriously, and you were groomed to be a classical pianist. You studied with Antonio Brico. Your father was a singer. But it sounds like there was so much pressure on you to excel in piano. You describe in your book that you even tried to overdose on aspirin because your father had pushed you to learn an especially difficult Liszt transcription of a Paganini piece.
Always remember that piece. Very fast, played very fast. Yes, I decided I would kill myself, and I was convinced that aspirin would do it, 100 or so. I guess it can do some damage, but I got over it, and didn't succeed in doing myself in. But I did feel a lot of pressure as a child. I suppose children who have any kind of a talent, whether they're dancing or singing, whatever, they at times they do feel pressured, and I think it's hard for parents not to push. Mine tried to be understanding, but I think they saw that I had a life in music, and consequently I became perhaps more of a disciplinarian on myself than I might have otherwise. But there was a lot of pressure to be ready for the public, to be prepared, to be ready to make music.
How were you introduced to folk music?
In a very unusual way. In fact, it was earlier today, a fellow in New York that has a show here, Gil Gross, brought me a present because I'd told often about this first hearing of Joe Stafford's recording when I was 15, a recording she made of Barbara Allen, "'Twas in the Merry Month of May," with her husband Paul Weston's arrangement behind it. Beautiful string orchestration. Now, Joe Stafford was a singer of popular songs, ballads, the same things my father was earning his living with, musical, theater songs, Rodgers and Hart. And she made an album of folk songs, and that was what I heard, was Barbara Allen. Gil brought me that record today. I don't think I've heard it in 30 years, and it changed my life entirely. And I became interested in the story and in folk music, and that led me to discover Pete Seeger, of course, and to start collecting American folk songs and doing them myself.
You described that when you started singing folk songs that your teacher, Antonio Brico, said to you that you were ungrateful, that you were callous to what God had given you, special gift. Boy, what a guilt trip.
Well, you know, she believed that she had a hot student on her hands, and I was memorizing a Rachmaninoff concerto I'll never forget at that point. She still says that I should continue to play it. I brought it out about 3 years ago. I'm doing a lot of symphony orchestra dates now. I sing with a lot of symphonies around the world. And Eric Kunzel had said to me, why don't you brush up on the Rachmaninoff second piano concerto? If you know that piano concerto, brushing up is only meant for someone who is a real workaholic. Because I brushed up, I took it to Gary Grafman, my friend Gary, and I played for him, and I said, what do you think? And he said, well, you know, you could certainly do it if you want to do nothing but that for the next year of your life. And instead, I chose to start my new book, Trust Your Heart. So I never played the second piano concerto with the Chicago Symphony 2 summers ago, but I have a book out instead. But Dr. Brico, in her passion for music, gave me so much. She gave me such a rich background in music, and of course I will be eternally grateful.
Judy Collins is my guest, and she's written an autobiography which is titled Trust Your Heart. When you started playing guitar to accompany yourself when you were singing, did you like the instrument, and have you ever felt as comfortable with it as you got to feel with the piano?
I love a fine guitarist, and I did what I could with the guitar. I do play the guitar occasionally in concerts today. And there was a point at which I wasn't playing piano at all. I was only playing guitar. And through those years, I used it consistently. And I did all right, as I say. I was limited. I didn't have the kind of imagination with the guitar that, say, somebody like Joni Mitchell had. She still will use extraordinary voicings to bring about the kind of harmonics she wants on the guitar. I felt my way along with it, but of course was always basically happier on the piano. This year will be, Terry, the anniversary of my 25th concert, my 25th anniversary of my first appearance at Carnegie Hall. And I'm doing my Carnegie Hall this year on the 27th of November, which is the day after Thanksgiving. It's a little early this year, I guess. And this year I'm going to bring back a couple of the songs that I did in the mid-60s. And I do play the piano, you know, from time to time. It's a wonderful repertoire of songs that I did with the guitar. And whenever I want to go back and do one of those, then I quickly brush up on those calluses. I don't play nearly as much as I used to, but I do love the sound of it.
When you started playing at the New York Greenwich Village clubs like Gertie's Folk City, you were already a mother. You were a young wife and mother in addition to being a performer. And I think a lot of the people who were on the folk scene then were single and were able to live much more lives that weren't, we didn't have to be home. you could hang out with who you would, when you would. Did you feel almost like you were living a double life, the life on stage and the life in your Connecticut home as a parent?
Well, I believe in, of course, people, women, being able to have careers and to do everything, to have, I think, that sense that there's a balance, that you can be involved passionately in your work and also be raising a family. It was a strain because of the traveling, and I think that's the strain. If I had been able to work in one place, I don't think I would have felt quite the pressure on my marriage or found myself in an unhappy separation and an unhappy loss of custody. I think it was a strain, but I still believe, wouldn't you know it, I'm an optimist after all. I believe that it's possible, and I did what I could with it. There were times when I took Clark with me.
Clark was your son, yeah.
Yeah,
is your son.
Clark is my son, my wonderful 28-year-old now. And I tried it some, took him with me on some of those trips. I think it becomes difficult if a child is older and really needs to be in school and needs to be with friends. But for a while there, I think we had a very well worked out situation. My husband was very willing to be a house husband. He was a scholar. He loved being able to study, take care of Clark while I was doing the thing that I was doing. So there were a lot of very good things about that. It's just that it got to be strained when our marriage started to fall apart, which I don't think was because of the career. I think it fell apart from within, from our own problems of relating to one another.
When you started playing folk music, it was a period when folk music was very identified with radical politics, with the peace movement, with the civil rights movement, and then with the counterculture. Did you have any political interests when you started singing, or did your political interests follow from the music?
Well, the involvement, I suppose, paralleled my education politically. I was becoming educated politically when I moved to New York. I was naive in certain areas, and I quickly, after a year and a half of living here, I had begun to understand more about what was going on politically and to take part in it in a very active way. And I was, as many people were, outraged with certain things that were happening, so that I was attracted to music that expressed those feelings. I had already been interested in songs that expressed pacifism, conscientious objection, which I believe in, and songs that expressed some of the feelings going on against the war in Vietnam. And the wonderful song of Shel Silverstein and Jim Friedman's about integration, Hey Nelly Nelly, it was called. So as my own education was growing, so was my interest in the diversity of the songs about what was happening. But I think the strength in my repertoire was always a kind of metaphysical, a loving of a metaphysical song, songs that transcended time and place.
Well, you know, you were called on a lot to perform at rallies. And after a while, I got the impression that you really didn't want to do that anymore.
I think in the early 70s, I began, in the mid-70s, I would say, I began to feel that I needed more time in personal ways. I felt that there was, that my performing and my marching and being involved was stretching very, very thin. And it was. I mean, there were a lot of demands made on people in the movement at that point, and naturally so. And I think this was combined with the feeling that I had that there are times when one has to say no and mean it, and there are reasons to say no. There are also, that makes it much more valid, I think, when you do say yes and can move with that conviction.
Judy Collins is my guest. She's joining us from the NPR studios in New York. She's written a new autobiography, which is titled Trust Your Heart, and that's also the title of a new album of hers that has just been released. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Judy Collins is my guest. You know, I have to ask you, we were talking before about how you started off as a pianist, and then you heard folk songs and you wanted to start singing that yourself. Did you know that you could sing?
Oh, yes. I'd been singing since I was... One of my first hits was I'll Be Home for Christmas, a song with my inimitable father playing accompaniment. I sang Laura is the face on the barroom floor. I don't know, whatever. I sang a lot when I was growing up. I sang in choirs. I sang in the church. I sang in the school. I did solos there. I had a group that in high school, junior high and high school, that was comprised of a number of my friends, and we made up skits, and I wrote the themes on the piano, and I sang them and talked them. I was very involved in storytelling before I hit folk music.
Well, tell me this. How is it that everybody was on you to practice piano because you had this gift, and nobody recognized the gift of your music, of your singing, to the same extent? Nobody was saying, oh, you must become a singer.
Well, I think it's because I hadn't found the thing that attracted me until I did find folk music. And after I began to play it, I was enthusiastically applauded by my family. They loved it. And I think Dr. Brico, for all of her wishing I'd become a pianist, actually liked it as well. I really do. In fact, she said to me once, did you write that piece about houses, the big orchestration? I think the orchestration reminded her, which I didn't do the orchestration, but I think it had certain overtones of Sibelius in it. And I think she heard her training coming through. And every reason that she should, because I think all of that early training helped me when I came to write my own songs, which was another big change for me because it drew me into an internal, interior world of autobiographical songs, the things that certain people have called art songs, which I began to do in the mid-60s and still do to this day.
Yeah, and you've done songs. You've actually introduced the work of performers who later became known, who weren't known as performers yet. I'm thinking of Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell. You really made their songs popular before anybody knew who the heck they were.
Yes, they were wonderful gifts. People who were undiscovered treasures, I like to think of them. And they came to me with songs which had been unexplored. Leonard hadn't even performed in public. He hadn't made a record. No one had heard these songs. The first two that I heard were Dress Rehearsal Rag, a song coincidentally about suicide, which I immediately adored, and Suzanne. And I did those both on In My Life. And they're very reflective songs. They're very, again, I think rather metaphysically structured. I think that theme from the beginning followed right through to the present, to Trust Your Heart, the most recent album. And it was reflected in songs like the Leonard Cohen songs. I once figured out that I recorded 12 of his songs over the years. And there were things of Pete Seeger's like Turn, Turn, Turn. And my song about called Nightingale, which is about transformation, that became the through line in the work, I think, even much more strongly than the idea of socially significant material. I left those to others more skilled at writing that, certainly, Tom Paxton and some of the writers that I, whose work I sang in throughout the years. I only wrote my first anti-war song a couple of years ago, and I haven't recorded that yet. And I wrote a song called Shoot First, which is very much about social significance. It's about violence among children. And that I do in concert quite regularly now, sort of a techno-pop version, which is, it's a tough song. And for me, it's an important song about my feelings against handgun use and against violence.
Do you think the fact that you were interested in pop songs and songs from the Broadway stage helped you continue your career after folk music lost lost a lot of its popularity in America? Because you had songs that weren't just connected with folk music, and you had one of your biggest hits in the 1970s with Stephen Sondheim's song "Send in the Clowns."
The moving force in my life has been musical and lyrical, and I have encompassed from the beginning very unusual types of songs. On the second album, for instance, there's a song called Golden Apples of the Sun. Now, what it is a setting of a Yeats poem. From the very beginning of being in a class, in a category, I was already breaking the rules and it was pointed out that I was breaking the rules. I certainly wasn't a traditional singer. By the third album, I'd begun to move into songs that were going to be very big popular hits. Popular music, I was always interested in the thing that would unite me in the song with a very large audience. I saw to the heart of the song what the message hopefully would be to the people to whom I was singing. On my third album, Turn, Turn, Turn and Tambourine Man, both became very big hits for the Byrds. And Jim McGuinn and I worked on those songs together, knowing that they had, how should I say it, a universal appeal. They didn't belong to a small area of music. They were big songs. And my process through these years that I've been making music has been to find the unusual, to move into Brecht and Weill in the mid-60s when no one, I mean, certainly wasn't considered folk music, to move into the Beatles songs in my life, to move into the songs, which was a natural step, the songs my father recorded, Where or When. And then, of course, to find Sondheim's song was a great gift. Send in the Clowns has seen me through a lot of rough and pleasant years.
You touch on something in the book that I don't think you've really talked on very much, and that is your former relationship with Stephen Stills, who was in Crosby, Stills, and Nash and was a very popular rock performer. Now, he wrote the song Judy Blue Eyes for you. I just happened to hear that again on the radio the other day. And I have to tell you, I still don't understand what the words mean.
Well, that's probably good.
I was wondering what kind of secrets the song is supposed to be betraying that are still inscrutable to me.
Well, that's poetic license. That's poetic charm. We can fit our meaning into these songs in any way that suits us. Stephen and I were together for a time during which he wrote the suite, and I assumed perhaps selfishly that the song is about me. Other people assumed the same. There are certain things in the song that I recall. I think that if, in fact, the song was written about me, which I hope it was, it's very flattering.
When you first started hearing that on the radio, and I guess it was 68 or 69 that it was a big hit, you couldn't miss hearing that.
It was just played over and over again.
Would you feel pride or sense of invasion of privacy, embarrassment, when you'd hear it on the radio?
At that point, it was just painful because we were having some difficulties, I should say, over some time. And it was painful. It was beautiful and very bittersweet to me to hear it. But I certainly couldn't see it in any kind of distance or with any kind of sense of clarity. It was just uncomfortable. Beautiful but uncomfortable. You've had that feeling.
Oh, sure. You were married when you were young, and you divorced, I guess, when you were in your late 20s or early 30s. And you've had other serious relationships, but you haven't married. And I know you're in the middle of a serious relationship now. And your book gives me the impression that you really don't want to get married again, that you like the idea of being in a committed relationship, but that you could do without the marriage part.
Yes, absolutely. And I feel bound to continue in this direction, because I think it's important for somebody not to be married. I do. I feel it is important somehow. It's become. I think it's important for people to know that it is possible to have a committed marriage. I really think of myself as married, a committed relationship on an emotional, and physical and spiritual level with someone, and that it needn't necessarily encompass marriage.
A lot of people, although your career was not tied to the 60s, a lot of people still, when they hear your voice, remember their days back in the 1960s.
Yes, that's right.
Does that bother you?
Oh, no, it's wonderful. It must remind us that we all come from a very hopeful time. I think it's probably very healthy. And people can tell you what they were doing when they first heard 20, 25 years worth of work. That's very exciting to me, to have been that ingrained in people's lives. People tell you about their weddings and the love affairs and the moments that meant something to them related to your music.
Well, what about you when you hear one of your records from the 1960s? What does it make you think about?
Well, I love it, and it sets up a memory in most cases of where I was, what I was doing, why I would have chosen the song that I was singing. Although that always seemed almost predestined, it still does. My relationship with music seems almost a karmically outlined, predestined situation. It feels comfortable. I feel as if I've known these songs for years, as if they somehow belong to me. They have overtones of other lives, always have. It's interesting because although I know I'm different in many ways, and we do change, we grow, we have things happen to us, there, when I hear my music, I'm reminded that essentially I'm always a certain person with a certain kind of view of the world, and that doesn't graphically alter with an artist. I think if you watch the work of painters, musicians, you see that they have a certain form, a certain shape to what it is that they are, to what it is that they do. And although they may go through many different media to explore it, it is an essence that remains. And that always surprises me when I hear my own work.
Well, Judy Collins, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and about your music. Thanks.
Thank you
for talking with us. My guest has been Judy Collins. Her autobiography has just been published by Houghton Mifflin. It's titled Trust Your Heart, which is also the title of her new album on Gold Castle Records. Judy Collins will perform at Carnegie Hall on November 27th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with composer Henry Mancini. He wrote the theme for the film The Pink Panther, the theme for the TV show Peter Gunn, and the songs Moon River and The Days of Wine and Roses. He also wrote the score for the new film The Glass Menagerie, so I hope you can join us.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dream.
Music from Judy Collins' new album. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Del Tredici describes why he gave up avant-garde music to return to tonality. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Lech Walesa's autobiography, A Way of Hope. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward spins a couple of break-in records from the 1950s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. The Transportation Department issued its first report card on airline performance today. The figures are designed to help consumers choose airlines with the best service. The report found flights in September were more than 15 minutes late, 25% of the time. American Airlines did the best job of arriving on time, with 84% of its flights arriving within 15 minutes of when they were scheduled to. But Leslie Rowland of the Air Transport Association says consumers should consider one major factor when they look at the on-time figures.
We can't single out any one carrier for doing the best or the worst, but something everybody should keep in mind when they're looking at the best and worst results is the areas of this country in which they operate. There are certain carriers that operate in the Northeast, and naturally, weather, they are more adversely affected by weather. There's some that primarily operate in the Southeast that don't have that problem as much. So we should keep those reasons in mind.
The report found airlines are doing a better job of providing service. Consumer complaints about poor service decreased for the second month in a row, dropping by a third between September and October. On the eve of Veterans Day, President Reagan announced at the White House that he wants to see a cabinet-level Department of Veteran Affairs.
Our nation will pause and remember those veterans who have served in the armed forces, both at home and abroad, and will remember those who gave their last measure fighting for what our country represents, freedom. There's not a better time or better way to salute those valiant men and women than to announce today my decision to support the creation of a cabinet-level Department of Veterans Affairs.
Currently, veterans programs are handled by the Veterans Administration, an independent agency. A cabinet-level department would give these matters more weight. Indications from the White House today that appeals court judge Anthony Kennedy's nomination to the Supreme Court is all but certain. Administration officials arranged courtesy calls for the California judge with key members of the Senate. However, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the president is still in the process of selecting his next nominee and that no announcement is expected until later in the week. The Supreme Court today ruled that the Internal Revenue Service does not have to comply with the Freedom of Information Act in certain cases. In the 6-0 decision, the High Court said the need for access to data does not outweigh the right to withhold tax return information and keep it confidential. Justices Scalia and Brennan abstained from today's ruling in a case brought by the Church of Scientology. Spain's socialist government has refused to automatically renew a 3-decade-old military pact with the United States that gives Washington the right to station troops there. As Joe Paley reports from Madrid, it's not that Spain wants U.S. troops out, it just wants fewer of them there.
This doesn't mean the end of American airmen and sailors in Spain, although in theory the Americans would have to leave altogether if there were no new treaty before next spring. Spain has refused to budge in spite of American claims that Western defenses would be weakened by the removal of 72 fighter bombers from a base near Madrid. For Spain, it's an expression of a growing political confidence, but also of a wish to promote a NATO that is more solidly based in Europe and less dominated by America. The Spanish government doesn't want to fall out with the Americans. Indeed, it has repeatedly said that it seeks a new treaty. But it does insist on the right to decide for itself how many troops from another country shall be based on its soil.
The BBC's Joe Paley from Madrid. President Reagan today appeared to boost the dollar from record lows on European exchanges, saying he neither expects nor wants the dollar to fall further. Stocks fell again today on Wall Street after a brief rally, after seesawing in a 50-point range. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down more than 22 points at 1878.15. I'm Michael Richards, National Public Radio News, from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1938, Orson Welles made his historic broadcast, War of the Worlds. Nearly 18 years later, two guys from New York City made a record that also opened with an announcement about alien invaders. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers that quirky hit from 56, The Flying Saucer.
We interrupt this record to bring you a special bulletin. The reports of a flying saucer hovering over the city have been confirmed. The flying saucers are real.
News like that wouldn't have surprised anybody in the summer of 1956. After all, rock and roll was slowly but surely taking over the music business, sort of like an alien taking over a healthy, sane body in a cheesy science fiction flick. And just like the scientists in one of those movies, America didn't seem to have any way of stopping it. That was too bad, too. Everybody knew rock and roll was unmusical, primitive, and immoral, but it took two guys from New York City to make it sort of illegal, too. Their names were Bill Buchanan and Dickie Goodman, and to be honest, other than that, I don't know much about them. I do know that they knew their way around the music business in New York and were quick with a razor blade, editing tape in expert fashion, taking tiny snippets of popular songs and slipping them into a crazy simulated radio broadcast. It's easier to listen to than to explain, though, so here's a part of The Flying Saucer.
We interrupt this record to bring you a special bulletin. The reports of a flying saucer hovering over the city have been confirmed. The flying saucers are real.
Real, well, I feel what my heart can't conceal.
That was the Clatters recording, Too Real. We switch you now to our on-the-spot reporter downtown.
Come on, baby, let's go downtown.
Take it away, John Cameron Cameron.
This is John Cameron Cameron downtown. Pardon me, madam. Would you tell our audience what would you do if the saucer were to land?
Get back in the air!
Thank you. And now the thin gentleman there.
What I'm gonna do is hard to tell.
The gentleman with the guitar. What would you do, sir?
Would just take a walk down the street.
Thank you. We return you now.
This is Brent, your outer space disc jockey, with a request for Earth.
Earth Angel, Earth Angel.
That was the Pelicans' outer space recording Earth. I've just been handed a bulletin. The flying saucer has just landed. We switch you again downtown.
Here we are again. We have with us Professor Sir Cedric Fentingmold of the British Institute. The professor is approaching a saucer to see if there's possibly any sign of life aboard.
Well, I'm sure something. Are you there?
I hear you knocking. But you can't come in.
That was Laughing Lewis's record, Knocking.
This is John Cameron Cameron on the spot. And now I believe we're about to hear the words of the first spaceman ever to land on Earth.
La, ba, boom, ma, la, ba, boom.
The Flying Saucer was more than a novelty record. It's almost a time capsule of the era in which it was recorded. The disc jockey, who breathlessly announces the songs and gets them all wrong, is obviously supposed to be the pioneering Alan Freed. John Cameron Cameron is supposed to be the famed news announcer, John Cameron Swayze. And I trust you recognize the Platters, Fats Domino, Elvis Presley, and the Penguins singing Earth Angel in among the cosmic debris. Of course, summertime is silly time, and the Flying Saucer, which may have been intended for DJs only, for use as a comic relief, took off like a rocket. So did the records they used. Earth Angel had died around the beginning of the year, but suddenly it was picking up sales. Naturally, all of the labels whose songs were on the record sued, so Buchanan and Goodman went underground. Eventually, the record was declared legal, and the two went on to mock Sputnik, the Untouchables TV show, and Santa Claus. And although these records never matched the original Flying Saucer, they did all right. There's a funny sequel to this story, though. In 1959, Jerry Lee Lewis went on a short but controversial British tour. Along for the ride was his brand-new 13-year-old wife and her sister. The British press had a field day with him, and when he returned to the States, Jerry Lee's career was in a shambles. What to do? Sam Phillips, who owned Sun Records, had an idea. He grabbed Memphis disc jockey George Klein and a stack of records and produced The Return of Jerry Lee.
We take you now to the Municipal Airport in Memphis, Tennessee, where rock and roll singer Jerry Lee Lewis and his new bride have just arrived from a tour of the British Isles. Our on-the-spot announcer has just notified us that Mr. Lewis has consented to an interview. Come in, Edward R. Edward.
This is Edward R. Edward at the Municipal Airport in Memphis, Tennessee. Mr. Lewis, I'd like to ask you this question. How do you feel about being back home?
Feels good.
Well, Jerry, what did you say when the news of your marriage broke over in London?
The news is out all over town.
Well, how did you manage to get your marriage license with your wife being so young?
I told a little lie.
Well, Jerry Lee, where did you meet your charming wife?
Loving at the high school hall.
How did you propose to your wife?
Open up a honey, it's your lover boy, me, that's a knockin'.
Mr. Lewis, I see you have your attractive bride with you. Would you like to tell the audience something about her?
Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about the whole situation?
I'm feeling sorry.
Jerry, this question, do you think women find you attractive?
Well, I ain't bragging. It's understood.
What did you say when the London critics voiced their opinion of your show?
I know that I should leave.
Well, Jerry, here's a question rather important to our audience. Were the conservative Britons very shaken over your behavior?
Whole lot of shaking going on.
Sam thought it was a cute record because it made fun of the whole situation. But by the time they got it out, nothing could help Jerry Lee. Break-in records, which is what these novelties came to be called, show up every now and again, especially when a fad or news item captures teenagers' fantasies. The lawyers rage, but in the end, it's just good, goofy fun.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
I believe the spaceman has a final parting word.
See you later, alligator.
We return you now to our studios.
The spacemen have gone again, but look to the skies. The saucers will always be there.
Always be there.
Goodbye, Earth people.
This is Fresh Air. In composer David Del Tredici's press photo, he's wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with the words, "Tonality Lives." Del Tredici composes lush, large-scale, lyrical orchestral music. He began writing tonal music in the modern age of dissonance when he started working with the texts from Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. His 1976 piece, Final Alice, is considered a breakthrough work in what's been called the return to tonality. Del Tredici won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 1980 for his piece In Memory of a Summer Day, based on the preface to Through the Looking Glass.
Air composers breathed was atonal. That was somehow, without anyone really saying it, the only way to go. And here I was suddenly writing long stretches in D major with very lush, romantic, Straussian, Mahler melodies. This just seemed madness in a certain kind of way. Yet at the same time, it came out of my basic instinctual response to music. I was excited. This is what there was. So I had to, in a sense, go with that. On the other hand, my appraising eye saw that it was very much against what was acceptable at that time.
Which was what?
A kind of atonal, dissonant world. That's what modern music was supposed to be. Contemporary music was dissonant, as far as anyone knew. And no one anticipated the fact that somehow going backwards, that is, towards tonality, would be going forwards.
And when we say tonality, why don't you describe what you mean?
Well, when I mean tonality, I mean in my case, really very functional tonality, the language of Mahler, of Strauss, the romantic vocabulary of chords that everyone is familiar with.
Do you think you could describe some of the musical elements that really appeal to you from the past and contemporary musical ideas that appeal to you too? Because I don't think it would be fair to say that your music is just rooted in music of the 19th century.
No. It's interesting. For me, as I think with many composers, what got me involved in tonality was a text. The ideas coming out of a text. In my case, it was Alice in Wonderland. And not just the book, but the idea behind the book, the way it was written. For example, Lewis Carroll improvised those stories for a real-life Alice, Alice Pleasance Liddell, whom he had great fondness for. And the idea of putting that sentiment, even those poems, into a piece like Final Alice caused me to look for a language that reflected love and a certain kind of enchantment. The stories themselves are full of whimsy and humor. These sentiments, too, I felt didn't lend themselves to atonality.
There was silence in the court whilst the white rabbit read out these verses.
They told me you had been to
working on a series of pieces based on the text of Alice in Wonderland for years. You were doing pieces on that. I think you've done your last Alice piece, and you've entered into what I guess is a new period of your life as a composer.
Well, it's interesting. In this last year, a number of different organizations have kind of made theatrical versions of my pieces, which I've often been told are like operas. Even people say, why don't you write an opera? And the idea of other people seeing dramatic possibilities in my music is in a way pushing me in another direction, I feel. And I'm in putting my toe into the water of the collaboration which is required to write something like an opera. I've always been afraid of collaboration. I wanted the whole thing to be me, to be a very personal expression of myself. And I was kind of afraid of librettists and, you know, scenic designers and input. All of that kind of put me off. But anyway, this is sort of a new experience for me, and it's kind of exciting.
So are you working with the input yet?
Yeah, I'm accepting input and hanging on, hoping I don't dissolve in the process.
Now, you're also working on a commission for the New York Philharmonic, yes?
Right. In fact, that commission is a co-commission with the Royal Philharmonic of London. Yes, it is a non-Alice text, though it is a childhood poem, something called The Spider and the Fly by Mary Howitt.
Did the orchestras give you any specs when they commissioned the piece?
They just pray to God it won't be too long. Although in this case, Zubin Mehta and the Philharmonic have been most generous. And I said, can I have a chorus? Of course. Can I have two singers? Yes. Can it be any length? Of course. So they've been quite dreamy about it.
When you get a commission, do you have a day of elation followed by a prolonged period of panic?
Right, exactly. You sound like you've written a piece. That's it. One is thrilled with the idea of the commission. It's not so much panic sets in, but the long, arduous, quite lonely hours, days, almost years, that it takes to make a piece happen. And I don't think people ever realize how much energy is involved in doing that and how, at least for myself, I can't do anything else. I always say I can run my life, do all those things, or compose. When I'm composing, that's about all I can do.
I think one of the most difficult things for me to imagine is how a composer can sit at the piano and score for an entire orchestra and imagine an entire orchestra performing the piece.
Well, Terry, that is, you put your finger on a very fascinating, impossible, and challenging thing. Orchestrating is a very calculated risk. I mean, you're making a lot of guesses. I enjoy that. I mean, I could write for piano, an instrument I know completely, and know just how it'll sound, and that'll be that. But with the orchestra, there is a certain magical not knowing, which I feel brings out a kind of fantasy and daring I would not otherwise be prey to.
Now, you're working on a commission for the New York Philharmonic. Will the orchestra make itself available to you if you want to hear a sketch of a section that you're working on?
What a dream. Never, because the world of the orchestra is so expensive. You know, 20 minutes of orchestral time of a rehearsal would cost out of the blue. No, there is no time. It's not like a playwright writing a play and saying, I want to have a reading and gathering the actors together and sort of seeing how it flows and changing a word or a phrase or a speech to the here or there. That can't happen with an orchestral piece. I mean, I may take 2 years to write it, but the rehearsals will begin 3 days before the performance, and that's it. It'll suddenly be thrown into my face, all of these thoughts. It's really quite a frightening time, and I often get quite physically sick during that first rehearsal, and I tell people, chain me to a chair and gag me and don't let me say a thing, because I've learned that with a great orchestra, in 3 days, they can go from not knowing it to a superb performance. I mean, they're real professionals and they're geared to learn that quickly.
Have you ever gotten into a fight with a conductor about how a piece should be interpreted?
Always. That's why
you want to be gagged.
De rigueur. No, that's part of the game. In fact, when I conduct my own music, I'm sort of disappointed. I have nobody to fight with.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Are you going to head back to your piano now?
You make it sound like jail.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Terry, very much.
Composer David Del Tredici spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Jackie Leiden is co-hosting the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Jackie.
Hello.
What stories are you following?
Tonight, NPR's Wendy Kaufman in California will take a look at resentment over the enrollment of Asian students at Berkeley, where their academic achievements have qualified them to a greater degree than the quota there. We're also going to Enniskillen, Ireland, the town where a bomb went off on Sunday, killing 11 people, and we'll visit with an Irish Catholic priest who's ministered to Protestants there. And last, an interview with Lear Magazine, a new magazine for women who weren't born yesterday.
Thanks, Jackie. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of A Way of Hope, the autobiography of Solidarity leader Lech Walesa. It's been reported that the manuscript was smuggled out of Poland. The publisher of the American edition of the book, Henry Holt, has only said that it was published without the express permission of Polish authorities. The manuscript is also being translated and published in 14 other countries.
A Way of Hope is less the autobiography of Lech Walesa than a scrapbook of the Polish Solidarity movement, from its beginnings in 1970 to its repression in 1981. In December 1981, after 500 days of nonviolent revolution, Poland invaded itself. From Walesa's agreeable hodgepodge of rueful hindsight and impatient reminiscence, we don't learn much that's new historically, but we do get a lively sense of just how scary this man must have seemed to his bureaucratic masters. Suppose you're a Communist Party apparatchik in a Stalinist drab Eastern European People's Republic, with Big Mother and her Red Army looking over your shoulder and an economy that's falling apart. When you go to bed at night, imagine your worst dream with a bandit's mustache. He wouldn't be a student. You crushed the universities in 1968. He wouldn't be an intellectual. You had bought off most of them. And he wouldn't be Jewish. It's never been popular in Poland. He would have to be a worker himself, and a Catholic, like 90% of his fellow citizens, and a romantic. What other country ever chose a concert pianist like Paderewski as its prime minister? Walesa was exactly the sort of worker hero most embarrassing to applied Marxist-Leninism. He was born of peasant stock on the Vistula. His father was a carpenter, broken in a Nazi labor camp. His stepfather made him walk 5 miles barefoot to the village school, where he learned to shoot a bow and arrow. In 1970, as a 27-year-old electrician in the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk, innocent of books, theory, and jargon, out of the passions of the workplace and the theater of the streets, he invented himself, an instant Walesa, a spontaneous combustion of leadership. He couldn't carry a tune, especially not the Internationale, but when he spoke to boilermakers and machinists, he sang their thinking. 10 years later, solidarity would likewise improvise itself into that nightmare of any dictatorship of the proletariat, an independent labor union. During those 10 years, before he went over the shipyard wall and into history, he would go to prison at least as often as the 7 times he fathered children. He would also develop the cunning and the caution that maddened the radicals in his own camp, as much as his inclination to go it alone with his crucifix and his mystical sense of communion with the workers and the church. Somehow, as if by bow and arrow, he had hit upon a Polish liberation theology. Solidarity's 21 Articles of 1980 demanded free trade unions, the right to strike, and an end to censorship. "We saw nothing revolutionary in what happened," he remembers of those 500 days. "We merely felt that after so many years of living upside down, we were at last beginning to walk on our feet." But then there were 15 Soviet divisions in readiness on the border, and a frightened government declared martial law, and Polish soldiers shot Polish workers, and Solidarity's membership went to jail or underground. Walesa himself became a symbol, like the famous Gdansk memorial of the anchor and the cross, a harpoon in the body of a whale. I wish his book were more substantial, but maybe he was too busy making history to write it. Maybe, because he's never stopped insisting on his freedom, he needs an epic movie to imagine him, over the wall and into our hearts.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's what's coming up on tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with adventure writer Tim Cahill about how a clumsy kind of guy who gets easily lost ended up scuba diving in shark-infested waters, tracking grizzly bears in Montana, and driving from the tip of South America to Alaska. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a CD reissue of a 1960 recording of Tchaikovsky's Last Three Symphonies. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss how words can mislead, or how a direct flight can be anything but. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.